Understanding Literary Genre. The third talk in a series on issues in biblical interpretation was presented by Ron Julian on November 20, 1990, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm taking a class at the university this quarter called Religious Life in the United States. And one of the things that we have been looking at is the debate between the fundamentalists and the modernists around the 1920s. It gives you a lot to think about, all of the different issues that they kicked around. But one of the issues was the authority of the Bible. And there were a number of people at that time, and really before that time, who thought that in order to preserve the authority of the Bible, we need to eliminate anything human about the book. They wouldn't go as far as saying that it was dictated by God exactly, but just about. I mean, it would get that close. And they would argue that, some would, that if we allow for individual expression on the part of the authors involved or having to look for anything about the particular historical context in which they were writing or any of that sort of stuff, that's taking and removing it away from us. It's not the Word of God anymore. And that's so part of their defense of the integrity of the book was this approach to it, that basically I could just open it up and read anywhere and I'd be looking at pure, unadulterated God stuff. I mean, just right there. I can take it anywhere. So I'd like to propose that here's our situation. We are in a situation where you are in a situation where you have to go and speak to a group of lobbyists in Washington. You've been called to give the little devotional talk before their meeting. And the passage that you have been chosen to speak on comes out of the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 17, verse 8, passage for this group of Washington lobbyists. It says, "A bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers." Okay, now, here we are. This is straight from the mouth of God, speaking to these Washington lobbyists. Proverbs 17, 8, "A bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers." Yeah, the question is, what am I going to say to these guys? Is God's message to them from this text? Well, what I would like to suggest is that there is an aspect of this book that we have to take into account, part of its humanness, part of the fact that it's written in human language. And that thing that we have to take into account is genre. That is, what is the particular type of literature that I'm looking at? What are its goals? How does it communicate? What kinds of things do I know about it before I go and try to apply its message? We talked last week about, in general terms, about things like context and background information and all of that stuff. Here we're talking really about a specific kind of background information that presumably the readers of the text had when they came to something like the book of Proverbs. They knew what to expect. They knew what sort of literature it was. I would suggest that in solution to our problem here, we have to understand that the Proverbs in the Bible are just like the Proverbs really from any culture, that if we understand the genre, that they are not intended to be absolute descriptions of the way things always are, or promises from God, or descriptions of necessarily about how you're supposed to do things. It's a proverb is a truism. It's a statement about life that is intended to bring about a certain kind of response from the listener. We don't get upset, for instance, that in our storehouse of proverbs we have absence makes the heart grow fonder and out of sight, out of mind. And the fact is that those two proverbs contradict each other. But it's not that, I mean, when we hear those, we don't think, man, the culture that thought those up was really stupid. They had absolutely no idea what was going on, because both of them are true from the right perspective and in the right kind of setting. Both of them describe the way that things work. The question is, what kind of setting are we talking about? How broad is the author intending to be? And in fact, all we have to do is turn the page over backwards into 15:27, I think it is, in Proverbs. It says, "He who profits illicitly troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live." Okay, well now, there's another perspective on bribes. The fact is, I think, that when we understand the genre of the proverb, when we see 17:8, we don't think God is trying to tell me that I ought to take bribes. He's just saying, if you look around you, isn't this in fact the way it is? That a bribe is the kind of thing that will make a person's way in the world? That's all it's saying. It's not even making a moral judgment on that at that point. It's just saying, isn't that the way it is? I think in the light of other things that are said in Proverbs, we can get an idea of what the moral judgment would be that would be made on a statement like that. But in and of itself, it's just a truism. It's just saying, this is the way it is. And so that, I think, is the sort of thing that we need to do with some of the Proverbs that we see that sometimes tend to get made into absolute sorts of promises, like raise up your child in the way he should go, and when he's older he shall not depart from it, and spare the rod and spoil the child, and those sorts of things, where there is a truism involved there, certainly, but it was never intended to be a word from on high saying, this is a promise from God, you do this and God will always pay off by doing that. So, what I'd like to talk about a little bit tonight, then, is a few of the genres that we run into in the Bible, and I have a few and sundry comments to make about them. This is not going to be very systematic. I've just picked a few genres that I think I know something about, and I'm going to point them out to you and make a few comments, and when I'm done doing that, then we'll stop. I don't know which to start with. Let's start with Hebrew poetry, since we were just looking at Proverbs. We come to something like the Psalms. There are a number of things we could say about the genre of the Psalms. What I wanted to concentrate on tonight is the kind of poetry that the Psalms are. We tend to think of poetry as being a certain text that has probably a certain rhythm to it, and probably the words at the end rhyme with each other. And for most of us, if we think poetry, that's all we would really know to say about it. That's probably what we were told when we were growing up. The poetry of the Old Testament, which we would find in Psalms, which we would find in Proverbs, which we will find scattered throughout the prophets and even the narrative books in the Old Testament, we don't call them poetry because they rhyme, because in fact they rarely rhyme. And if they did rhyme, it would be almost certainly an accident. Occasionally you'll find something clever about the poetry in the Bible, like Psalm 119, I think it is, where each section, all of the lines start with the same letter, you know, and it's in alphabetical order, so you've got Aleph and Beit and like that, you know. There, clearly, there's an organizing principle, but it you wouldn't notice it when you were saying it. You'd have to read it and scan down the line to notice even that it had happened. What characterizes Hebrew poetry, and what's important for us to try to understand as we go to read Hebrew poetry, is something that you may have heard of before. It's this notion of parallelism. The idea is that, and I think we can say this about the Hebrew language in general, when we take two statements, two sentences, there are two kinds of relationships that those sentences can have. There's a kind of linear relationship where we're talking about things that happen one after another. There's this, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this. Or else, with those two things, there's a parallel kind of arrangement. There's this, but I'm not done yet. I have something else to say about that, and let me say this. And now we'll move on to the next topic, but before I move on from that, let me say this. So it's like we've got pairs. Instead of one sentence followed by another, we've got pairs. Here's a pair of sentences, followed by a pair of sentences, followed by a pair of sentences. And the idea is that those pairs work together, that the two sentences together combine to communicate one idea. Sometimes it's fairly straightforward, the way they work together. And in fact, this is what most people think of when they think of parallelism, is that the two sentences basically mean the same thing. You say the same thing twice. So in Psalm 24 it says, "The earth is Yahweh's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who may ascend into the hill of Yahweh, and who may stand in his holy place?" So we have there a series of pairs that were working together, which basically, pretty closely, say the same thing. The earth is Yahweh's and all it contains, the world and all those who dwell in it. Now, even there, I think, though, we can see, it's not a straight synonym. The earth and the world, the earth and all it contains versus the world and those who dwell in it. When you put them together, you get this picture of the sentences working together, that we've got all the stuff and all the people. It's kind of that whole package. Habakkuk 3:18 says, "Yet I will exult in Yahweh, I will rejoice in the God of my salvation." Clearly, in both cases, we're talking about a joyful, positive sort of attitude towards God, but we've got "I will exult" and "I will rejoice," which are pretty close as synonyms. First time we have Yahweh, the second time we have the God of my salvation. But notice how those two phrases are pointing at the same person, but each one is filling it in a little bit. In essence, when I put those together, I have the sort of hidden sentence that says, Yahweh is the God of my salvation. Because I've put them together, and since I've equated them there, I'm saying there's this relationship between them. That was Habakkuk 3:18. We're going to look at some better examples of that sort of thing in a minute here. One of the things that is common to have happen is, if we could think of common pairs, I mean, we could do this. Day and night, salt and pepper, you take it. I mean, salt and pepper. And we could take those two and put them together and say, you know, he salts his food with joy and peppers his meal with thanksgiving, or something like that. I mean, the idea being that we're used to seeing salt and pepper go together, so we put one in the first one and one in the second one. So Sodom and Gomorrah is a common pair in the Old Testament. So in Zephaniah 2:9 we see, "Surely Moab shall be like Sodom, and the sons of Ammon like Gomorrah." Well, it's the same people he's talking about both times. They're going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah, is what he's saying. But I'll say the first one in the first sentence and the second one in the second sentence. We have the day and night pair. "By day will Yahweh command his kindness, and in the night his song shall be with me." There are some pairs that are so extreme that if I can get this one on this side and this one on the other side, then I've really encompassed the whole picture. And so, for instance, this is called, by the way, merism, M-E-R-I-S-M, if you're interested, where we have two extremes that represent the whole package. And I think a good example of this is in Psalm 95:4, where it says, "In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him." saying, okay, he's got it all the way down here and he's got it all the way up here, and so that means he's got the whole thing. There are a number of other types of parallelism that we could look at. Oftentimes, poetry likes to represent abstract ideas with concrete things that represent them. So, in Deuteronomy 32:41, it says, I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword will devour flesh. Okay, we've got the arrows and the sword as two concrete examples of battle and warfare. The nations have fallen into the pit they have dug. Their feet are caught in the net they have hidden. And here are these two examples of they dug their own grave, and that's the kind of expression we would use. They have fallen into the pit that they dug. Their feet are caught in the net that they have hidden. Two specific examples, neither of which are actually what happened. What they have done is that they have been caught in their own devices. Their own schemings have backfired on them. All right. Now, I think the one that is probably going to be most interesting to us to talk about are these sort of situations where the two sentences work together to make this bigger whole. Because this is the thing, this is the place where noticing the parallelism can really help you make decisions about what's going on. Okay, so for instance, in Psalm 38:3, it says, there is no soundness in my flesh because of your anger, talking to God. There is no peace in my bones because of my sin. Okay, now, there is no soundness in my flesh, there is no peace in my bones. Those are just two concrete examples of this. I am troubled because of something. But what am I troubled because of? I am troubled because of your anger in the first one. I am troubled because of my sin in the second one. Clearly, in those things being put together, the idea is that I am troubled because of your anger at my sin. I mean, it is my sin that has brought about your anger. That's why the two things have been combined. In Psalm 51, David says, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A heart broken and contrite, O God, you will not despise. Okay, and so we have in the first one, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. In the next one, a broken heart is something that God will not despise. So, again, the whole picture that gets painted is the sacrifice that God will not despise is this. There is a kind of sacrifice that God would despise, but here is a kind that God will not despise. And the place where I think this is very helpful in sorting things out is if we were to look at Hebrews chapter 10, where the author of Hebrews quotes from Habakkuk 2:4. Habakkuk 2:4 is a very important passage in the Old Testament. Paul refers to it several times. The author of Hebrews refers to it. And the reason I'm looking in Hebrews is because there are a few kinks in this in terms of translation and going from the Hebrew to the Greek and everything that I don't want to sort out right now. And it's best if we just look at Hebrews. In Hebrews 10:38, the author is quoting Habakkuk 2:4, and it says, but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. Now, I would say that these are lines that are in parallel. What we have in the first statement is my righteous one, the one, God's righteous one. And we have to understand what that was talking about. When we look at the concept of being righteous before God, we're talking about someone who, with whom God is pleased. Someone that God looks at and says, you're okay with me. All right? So my righteous one shall live by faith. It is his faith that will make my righteous one live. And in fact, we can unpack that whole statement, and what he's really saying is, the person that I am pleased with, the person who is righteous before me, is going to live And the reason he's going to live is that the person who's righteous before me is the person that has faith. The one who is right before me will live because of his faith. So it is his faith that is making him right before me, and it is faith that is making him live. And we can see that more clearly as we look at the next statement in parallel with that. But if he shrinks back, and here shrinking back is the opposite of having faith, continuing to trust God is no way, I'm backing off of this. If he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. And that is in parallel with, in fact, here though it's in contrast with, it's the opposite to my righteous one living by his faith. We have these two groups. There is the person who is right before God because of his faith, and he will live because of that. And then there is the person with whom God's soul takes no pleasure because he has no faith. And presumably, he will not live because of it. God not being pleased with him, he will not live. And notice what the author of Hebrews says about this in the next verse. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. So there he's seeing the parallelism that way. There are those who shrink back to destruction. Well, it doesn't say anything in there about destruction explicitly. It says God's righteous one will live, and that the one who shrinks back, God is not pleased with. Well, but when you put those two ideas together, that's the one that God is not pleased with is the one that's not right before him, and the one that's not right before him is not going to live. I mean, each sentence has elements of the whole that are all put together. Okay, so what I would like to suggest is that, yeah.
Are you saying then that those are not the same people, even though it's and? You're saying...
Right. Okay. I think and is...
That's sort of incidental to the parallelism you're saying.
Right. And is not a good translation there. You partly have to realize that in Hebrew, and means and, but, however, now, I mean, any number of things that you have to decide on the syntactic relationship between the sentences.
But that the two could not be the same person, that's what you're...
Right, yes. Yes, and the idea is that there are these two groups. There is my righteous one who shall live by faith, and then there is the one who shrinks back, whom God is not pleased with. What I'm suggesting is that by being aware of such things, if we start to look for those things when we're looking especially, well, yes, basically at things from the Old Testament, there are certain things in the New Testament like the Magnificat, the song that Mary sings, and the song of Zacharias, both of them that we see in Luke, that have a very Old Testamentish flavor, where I think we could argue that there's parallelism happening in there too. But all through the Old Testament, we would do well to be on the lookout for this notion, not just that two sentences are saying the same thing, but that two sentences are working together to come together to create a whole that's bigger than either one of the pieces. We do have to be careful. This example was pointed out in a book that I read. What did I do with this here? There is a scene in Judges where Deborah is going to kill, I don't remember his name. She goes into the tent and she's going to do this guy in. And in Judges 5:26 it says, she reached out her hand for the tent peg and her right hand for the workman's hammer. Now, it used to be argued, I mean, this is not an important passage, obviously, but they used to be argued by some because of a very strict understanding of what Hebrew parallelism was all about, you know, that it was two synonymous lines, that the word for tent peg and the word for hammer in Hebrew must mean the same thing, that she was reaching for this thing that could alternately be called a tent peg or a hammer. And I guess they used to hammer with their tent pegs or something like that. But that's where we're being overly literal and really dumb. And I think it's fairly clear to see in the statement that what she's doing is she's reaching with one hand for the peg and she's reaching with the other hand for the hammer and she's going to go like that. So the only reason I bring that up is just to warn you that it's possible to go hog wild with this stuff and start making real simplistic and arbitrary kinds of decisions that you don't want to do. Okay, well, there's an example of where I think understanding something about the genre can help us to make decisions in various places. At least it can help us to understand as clearly, well, more clearly than we might otherwise have done, what sort of a thing the author is saying. All right, now let me take you to another example of...
Before you go,
yes.
Is that parallelism limited to the poetry, or is it also found in narrative?
Yes, I would say it's found in narrative as well. And what happens is, that's where you just have to sort of be aware and prepared for it. The story will be going along, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And somewhere, because the author has an idea that he wants to express a little more fully, he'll stop, and instead of moving on, he'll have these two sentences that work together in parallel.
So if you see parallelism, you don't automatically say, oh, I'm in poetry.
Right. Although it is kind of a poetic device, but it can occur. It is a poetic device that can occur in narrative as well.
Is parallelism limited to two parallel ideas emerge into one, or is it sometimes triple ideas emerge into one?
It is sometimes triple ideas. There are sometimes where you have three lines. There are sometimes where it is hard to tell if there is any parallelism there or not. If you're in the Psalms, you can go through and you can see, these two, and then it just, there will be spots where it gets sort of formless and void. It's hard to tell exactly. Is there parallelism going on here or not? An example, I think, of one where there's, just for an example of where there's...
The principle is that there's multiple sentences.
Yes, it is typically...
Together make one.
Yes, it is typically two. I mean, by far, the most examples of that sort of thing are two. But I would say that the very first verse in the Psalms, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, that's an example of a triple parallelism. That those are three concrete examples that are supposed to fill out a picture of what sort of a person is blessed if they're not like that. So yes, there is...
Do the interpreters make some decisions for us by, in some of the translations, setting things off that they're considering to be poetry and moving in and out of narrative?
Yes.
Does that fundamentally?
It's helpful, I think.
And would you generally say that in the good translations that's fairly?
I think it's pretty reliable. I like that myself. There are narrative something. New American Standard does not do that. But New International, at least in some editions that I've seen, will do that, where something that's considered to be a poetic section will be indented and sort of put in formal, you know, the lines will line up so that when you get to the end of the line, you know, it doesn't wrap around like a regular paragraph of text, but it looks laid out like lines of poetry. And that can be helpful to see. And usually their judgment on those things is pretty good, I think. But
excuse me. Do you interpret them slightly differently when you come upon those? Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
Well,
class of interpretation here.
Are
you saying you kind of loosen up the text? It's cruising along in this narrative about Deborah, and then she does this deal. You just kind of. I mean, could you have even said, well, you would have no problem with her reaching for the peg with her right hand and then putting it in and then picking up the hammer? We don't have a... Is that what I'm hearing you say, that it just kind of loosens up the...
Well, if I understand what you mean by loosen up, I think I can buy that. All I really want to get across here is that if I'm aware of this phenomenon of parallelism, it will keep me from making rash decisions. Like if I see two statements together and one of them talks about one thing and the next one talks about a different thing, I have to be prepared for the fact that these two sentences might be trying to work together to both be pointing to one idea. It's that idea that these two sentences, instead of being two individual, unique statements, I've made one point and now I'm moving on to another point. Sort of the genius of Hebrew poetry is I'm going to make my point by making two points together. And that's what I think we need to be prepared for. And if we're not prepared for that, we can end up interpreting the text in an overly literal sort of fashion. That is, thinking, well, the biggest mistake I could make would think is, well, he must have a new idea to present here or he wouldn't have said it again. That's don't want to say that, because the whole point is that the way they liked to do it in poetry was, I'm going to say it several times so that I can paint a fuller picture.
And a lot of the prophetic things seem to be in poetry.
Yes, they are.
Is there any significance in your mind to the reason for that? Or, I mean, does that make it more difficult to understand exactly what, thus saith the Lord kind of thing, speaking through Isaiah or Jeremiah or something?
I don't think it makes it any more difficult to understand. I think the things that make prophecy difficult to understand are not its poetry, but it's all the stuff you've got left when you take the poetry out. I mean, the poetry can be helpful. I mean, in the...
Well, like what Terry's saying, poetry is a little looser. It sort of gives you images and pictures. The words sometimes working together, like you pointed out, may mean something other than what they actually say, in a sense.
Well, okay, yes. Yes, that's a good point. And this is... Well, there's a lot that could be said about this, but there is a... I don't want to step on any toes here. I don't know where you all are coming from on this. I'm just saying, there is a theological system that has been very influential in the church in our century that is called dispensationalism. And one of the keys to the dispensational approach to the Bible is what they refer to as a literal interpretation of the text. And in particular, they're talking about a literal interpretation of prophetic texts, because one of the key things that dispensationalism wants to assert is that there is a literal fulfillment of all of the prophecies concerning Israel in the Old Testament that clearly are not fulfilled literally in the church. So the church and Israel are two distinctly different entities, and we need to keep them separate and not get them confused. And that leads to really far-reaching theological conclusions that we could talk about, but I don't want to go into. Now, I think that one of the dangers that sort of approach could fall into, and that dispensationalists have been called on, and they've sort of had to back off and try to explain what they mean by this literal interpretation of the text, is the fact is, in that sense, yes, much of prophecy is in poetic language, where it may be that the reality that's being talked about is being talked about in terms of concrete images that are not the thing necessarily that is at stake. For instance, if I see a picture of a battle that describes chariots and horses and all of that kind of stuff, there are sort of two models I could have. The prophet is tuning in on his prophetic TV set and he sees this picture of horses and chariots there, and he's just writing it down. Okay, I see some horses and some chariots, and there's Bobby and Susie. That's one model. The second model is that the prophet sees a battle, knows that there is some sort of a struggle going on, and describes that battle in terms of chariots and horses and that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that we have to keep in mind, and that is true. The prophetic nature of prophecy does mean that we have to at least ask that question when we go to look at it. Certainly, even dispensationalists, when we read that one on that great and glorious day, the mountains are going to clap their hands, They don't believe that mountains are going to grow hands and clap. Or when the Revelation talks about the beast that's going to come sometime, if nobody can quite agree on when, nobody really believes that it's going to literally be this animal that's going to come with fangs and that sort of stuff. Everybody thinks that it's meant to symbolize something else. So the question we have to ask is not, is it appropriate to interpret non-literally, because clearly it is. The question is just, how is the best way to go about making those decisions? And I'm not in a position to answer that question tonight. I'm just trying to suggest that the more we become familiar with the genres that they're dealing with, the better prepared we are for the kind of thing that the author might be doing. And so I'm prepared to consider the options more intelligently than I would be otherwise. Okay, there's another kind of genre in the Bible I want to talk about briefly here, much more briefly than it deserves, but just to say something. That's the parables of Jesus. There's one fundamental kind of distinction that we have to make when we talk about what sort of a genre are Jesus' parables. There are a number of people in the history of the church who have taken Jesus' parables to be allegorical. And what we mean by that is that an allegory, for our purposes, what we're talking about is a story that is primarily intended to have symbolic labels put on the elements in the story. And so when I replace the symbols with the reality, then I've decoded the message. You know, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is an allegory, and so we've got Christian who's has a journey with a burden on his back, and he can't find anybody to take the burden off his back. And along the way, he meets Mr. Worldly Wise Man, and, you know, those things where we take each one of the elements in the allegory and plug in what is the person or thing that he's talking about. And then I read it, and I've sort of decoded the message. Now I see what it is that it's talking about. An extreme example of that approach is what Augustine did to the parable of the Good Samaritan. I don't have the list here with me. When I talk about parables, I usually bring that list because it's sort of entertaining to look at all of the things that he said. But he goes to great lengths. For instance, to give you an idea, the innkeeper in the parable of the Good Samaritan is the Apostle Paul. The payment, you know, the payment that the Good Samaritan makes is Jesus' death on the cross, I think. And the being beat up by robbers is being burdened under the burden of the law, and, you know, those sorts of things. See, the idea being, I'm not interested in the story as a story. I'm not interested in how the story works or how it reads as a story. I'm interested in plugging in the labels. So it's not a man was lying by the side of the road beat up by robbers. It's a man was struggling under the burden of the law, and Jesus came along and paid the price. And the innkeeper took care of him. The Apostle Paul did this for him. See, it's like a code. It's that sort of approach. There is a more conservative way of doing that, which, I mean, very few people understand the parables in that way anymore. But many more would use that sort of approach in a much more conservative way. For instance, when I was first taught about parables, I was taught that in the parable of the mustard seed, where Jesus says, now the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed that, although it's the smallest seed in the garden, man plants it and it grows up into a big tree and the birds of the air make their nests in it. Okay, well, I was taught the picture is the kingdom of God is started with Jesus. It grows up into these branches. So this is the church throughout history, but evil and apostasy comes along into the church in the form of these birds that are nesting in the branches. Now, why do we say that? The argument is that birds always represent evil, that birds basically are a code word for evil. And And we could look at the parable of the, notice the seed, the sower of the seed, where the birds come along and take the seed away. See, that shows that the birds represent evil. Well, the question is, that the question we have to decide about the genre of parables is that the way they communicated or not? Is that what Jesus meant to do or not? There is another choice, and this is what I would like to suggest is, in fact, what's going on, that parables are not allegories where there's we're looking for the symbolic name that each thing in the parable has, but rather they're analogies. That is, Jesus is saying, you want to understand something about this? Well, let me tell you. It's like this. Now, it may be, and it will be, that sometimes elements in the two stories correspond. I mean, we can say that this element in the parable of the mustard seed represents the preaching of the gospel or something like that. That's okay. That's not what's at stake. The issue is, and this is the important question, the issue is the story itself supposed to make sense? Is the story itself supposed to speak to me and say, oh yes, okay, I'm looking at that story as a story and seeing what happens there. And when I have understood that story, now I have understood something about the kingdom of heaven. And that's what I would like to suggest that Jesus is doing. Now, there's an earlier example of a parable that does just that sort of thing, I think, in the Old Testament, in 2 Samuel 12. This is right after David has done the terrible thing that he did by taking Bathsheba and killing her husband. I mean, it's terrible stuff. Nathan, the prophet, comes to David, and he said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die, and he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. Nathan then said to David, you are the man. Okay, now, what's going on here? Nathan tells this story to get David's interest. Is it, let me tell you a story. And David understands the story totally in terms of, you know, what happened. If I were in that situation, how would I feel? Okay? And then after he's done that, then Nathan is saying, no, you see, I'm making an analogy here between what happened in this story and what you did. You know how you feel? You get in that story, you know how you feel about what that guy did? That's how you ought to be feeling about what you did, because it's the same thing happening. Now, I think Jesus pulls a very similar sort of thing on the Pharisees in Matthew 21. Oh, there's one thing I wanted to comment on there. Notice that in that story that Nathan told, we aren't searching for what's the symbolic value of the traveler who came and needed to get fed. He's just an incidental part of the story that moves the story along, but he doesn't really represent anybody, I don't think. I mean, maybe you could make a case that he does, but I don't think so. What's important is a story where you feel how this big guy who's got lots of stuff rips off this poor guy who's got hardly anything. Okay, now, okay, in Matthew 21, 33, Jesus is talking to the chief priests and the elders, and he says, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. And when the harvest time approached, he sent his slaves to the vine growers to receive his produce. And the vine growers took his slaves and beat one and killed another and stoned a third. Again, he sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. But afterward he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the vine growers saw the son, they said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." And they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers? They said to him, this is the priests, the chief priests and the elders answering back to Jesus, they said to him, "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay him the proceeds at the proper seasons." Okay, well, we've got the same situation here where Jesus is telling this story that is basically indicting the people that he's talking to, and they have bought it as a story. They've heard it and they say, "Yeah, boy, that's really bad what those guys did." Now, see, I think that's a real helpful example to look at, because you'll notice, I think we're entirely justified in saying that the slaves that get sent along represent the prophets, and that the son whom he finally sends, that's Jesus. Very appropriate sort of symbolism there. That's fine. But the key is, yes, there we can make identifications between, yes, this represents this and this represents this. But the key is the story makes sense. It's the power of the story itself that we're interested in. So in the parable of the mustard seed, I would say, when I hear that story by itself, I have no reason to think that there's anything wrong with the birds. Do birds hurt trees when they nest in them? Birds have been nesting in trees since the beginning of when this whole thing got started, as far as I know, and the trees last a long time. It doesn't seem to hurt them at all. Whereas in the parable of the sower, birds do come along and steal seeds from that get planted. So in the one story, yes, the birds represent something bad, because my experience of birds in that situation tells me that they're doing something that I as a sower wouldn't want them to do. But in the story of the mustard seed, the birds don't represent anything bad, because what's bad about a bird being in a tree? There's nothing bad about a bird being in a tree. If I make the birds symbolize evil, then I've taken the story and it doesn't speak anymore as a story. It's just a code. And that's what I'm saying, is that the parables are not codes. They're stories, which are intended to make a point. So take the parable of the 10 virgins at midnight. 5 were foolish and 5 were not. When they went out to meet the bridegroom who was coming for the wedding, because 5 of them took oil for their lamps, and 5 of them didn't. Well, almost the first thing that we do when we come to that parable is, the key to understanding that parable is to ask the question, what does the oil represent? But all I'd like to suggest is that's not the first question to ask. The first question to ask is, what's happening in this story? And then, after I understand what's happening in this story, the next question is, what is he making that analogous to? And then finally, when I've done that, I may find that the oil represents something in reality, or I may find that it really doesn't. It's just an example of a kind of thing that he was talking about. And you can see how, where in that story, what might be happening is that Jesus is saying, with these groups, two groups here, 5 of them were foolish because they didn't take into account the fact that the bridegroom might be a long time in coming. 5 of them were not foolish because they did take into account that he might be long in coming. And then the rest of the story could just be to show you them in concrete terms that they would have been familiar with, what the consequences might be of not planning on someone being a long time in coming. That by not thinking in advance that he might be a long time in coming, you didn't make the preparations necessary for waiting for somebody who was going to be a long time in coming. Well, that's a difficult parable, and I'm not necessarily proposing a solution here, but I'm just saying that's the kind of thing that we need to do. The last question you would answer is, what does this stand for? You've got to understand the story first. Let me make a couple more comments about genre here, rushing along.
Ron, could I save your voice for just a minute?
Yes.
Ask an interpretation question about parables are stories that could be allegorical or have analogies in them. You're teaching us to look for the analogy, the teaching in the analogy. Can, however, parables be allegorical? How do we know when to look for the symbolism of the oil?
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that a parable as such is always an analogy, only secondarily an allegory. And the only way I could know that it was an allegory is by going through that process I was just describing. What's the sense of the story? Mm-hmm. What is the most likely thing for Jesus to be comparing it to? Because one of the things about the genre of the parable is that often Jesus doesn't tell you what the reality is that he's comparing it to. He just tells you the story and he leaves you to figure out what it's being. If there's a nice tight one-to-one correspondence between the elements in the story and the element in the reality, then great, take it. I go for it. What I'm saying is, though, I shouldn't let the fact that I can't find a one-to-one correspondence between everything in Jesus' story and the reality make me think that, oh, I must not have understood it, because that's not his purpose. And oftentimes there are going to be those elements in the story that are not intended to have their corresponding reality. Mm-hmm.
We're using allegorical as an adjective. I wonder if just a very basic thing you can help me with is, what's the difference between a parable and an allegory, the noun allegory?
Well, with an allegory, the purpose would be, an allegory would be a story that is intended to communicate in code, to communicate symbolically. This is one that I have not really worked through for myself. So, many years ago, Jack suggested, I don't even know what he thinks about it anymore because it's been years since I've heard him say anything about this, but years ago Jack suggested that the story of the sweeping, get rid of the demon and it goes away and it brings back seven more that are worse than itself, that story was intended to be an allegory. It's not, I mean, the story doesn't really make any sense. It's not real life or anything like that. It's just, in that case, it's intended to be speaking symbolically. The idea is to figure out what do the things represent. I don't know if that's possible. I'm not saying that it's impossible that Jesus ever spoke in allegory, but I think what I'm suggesting is when we look at his parables and what he was really doing, the evidence is much stronger that they were not intended to be symbolic code. They were intended to be stories that are analogous to something in real life.
It appears that his audience often didn't recognize he was speaking in a parable until he explained to them that that's what he was doing. Why is that that they didn't recognize that? Was that an uncommon thing?
No, I think it depends.
Or did you just catch him off guard?
He did. I think he told different. He had different purposes. Sometimes I think he meant the parable and the point of the parable, the whole thing, to be fairly clear and straightforward. It's certainly true. I mean, the one we looked at with the Pharisees, there, they understood the point of the whole thing, everything except that it's that last little bit where he's basically saying, it's you guys. That's the part that they didn't understand. But the story itself was very straightforward and they followed it. Some of the parables he told, in the kingdom parables, where he starts out talking about the sower and the several of the parables about the kingdom that he tells, the disciples come to him afterwards and say, "What did you mean by that?" They weren't quite sure where he was coming from. And there does seem to be this idea that there were going to be those people who would hear these stories and sort of be put off with by them and not understand them. And those who would hear these stories and be intrigued by them and pursue them and try to figure out what it is that he was talking about. So I guess that's a complicated answer to your question, that he has different purposes at different times. Sometimes he intends them to be difficult to understand. Sometimes he intends them not to be recognized at first as a parable, but for it to kind of sneak up on people. It all depends on who he's talking to and what he's trying to do, I think.
But in those situations where the parable is difficult to understand, it's because it's a difficult analogy, not because he's hiding a symbolic meaning.
Right. Now, someone could argue back at me, and if we had time to explore this, so I could go into all of this, that when Jesus gives his first explanation of the parable of the sower. The explanation he gives to them is to basically say, to give them, this represents this, this represents, you know, the bird is Satan, the seed is this, this is the... And so it sounds as if that what he's saying is that the way you interpret a parable is to stick in the symbolic code.
Right.
But I would argue when you look at the explanations that he gives of parables, that we can demonstrate that that's not really what it's about. That he's not contradicting, in fact he's supporting the kind of model that I'm suggesting. So yeah, I do mean to suggest that.
I might recall specifically his apostles will ask him, well, why did you speak that way in that parable? And Christ answers, because I didn't want those guys to figure it out.
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying. That's the part where he brings up that so that they will have ears but won't hear,
yes,
and eyes,
yes,
but won't see.
But I'm
going
to take you guys aside now. I'm going to explain it to you.
Even so, I think his explanation only goes part way in explaining them. What he's saying is, let me show you the reality that is being made analogous in my story. But what remains for them still is to figure out, having figured out now, here's the story and here's the reality, what's the point between them?
Mm-hmm.
What is the teaching of the parable? What is it telling me? And that's the part that Jesus doesn't explain even then. He tells them, okay, there's this correlation here between these elements, but he leaves them to find the point of it for themselves. That's not so easy to see in the parable of the sower, but in the other parable that he explains, I think it is clear that that has to be the case. And many others he doesn't explain, at least we don't get an explanation of them. And yet I think he's intending them to be able to be understood. But what you have to do, part of what it takes to be able to understand them, is you have to be willing to get into his frame of mind. You have to, it's a kind of puzzle that invites you to figure out what sort of things did this guy think? What was a likely thing for him to be drawing this analogy to? What sort of a point would he be wanting to make? And I think we can find the analogies, I mean the precedents for all of this, the points and the parables in the explicit teaching of Jesus as well. So we can say that the points he's making in these stories are all things that he clearly thought that were a part of his teaching and understanding of what was going on. I've got one more point I want to make before we leave here. The importance of getting the genre right sometimes can be crucial. I just want to point this out. In the lowly, beaten-up, downtrodden little book of James, which has not had a happy history in the church, has not been looked on with favor by many, many people will argue that the book of James is an example of wisdom literature, like the book of Proverbs. That is, it's a collection of sayings, a collection of wise sayings about, you know, here are things to avoid, here are things to do, rather than a letter. Although it starts out being addressed, James, to the 12 tribes of the dispersion and so forth, it's not really a letter, it's the New Testament book of Proverbs. Well, the only point I want to make is that it makes a tremendous amount of difference whether you approach the book of James that way or not. If you take it as the New Testament book of Proverbs, then you are not going to be looking for the flow of thought in the letter. You are not going to be looking for the context and how that informs what specific things mean, because the whole point of books like Proverbs is that they don't really have a context. They're a series of wise sayings. Some of them may be kind of pointed in the same direction. Some of them may point off in quite different directions. You might have right in the middle of something, you know, where did that come from? You know, that one that we looked at about the bribe, that doesn't seem to be particularly related to the stuff around it. What's it doing there? Well, it's just a little saying. Well, I don't think the book of James is an example of wisdom literature in that respect. I think it has coherence and context and all of that stuff, and that makes a tremendous amount of difference what you understand him to be saying. I think it has made a tremendous amount of difference to me in trying to understand what he's saying. Well, I'm not even going to begin to try to make the case for that now, but I just want to point out that look how much difference it makes which way you take it. There's a situation where the genre that you consider it to be is going to make all kinds of difference. And one of the famous scholars who looked at the book of James argued that the various pieces of advice in James are not being written to a real community. It's not James looking at real problems out there and saying, this is what I think ought to be going on. He is instead just collecting various pieces of good advice and sort of putting them into hypothetical situations that don't really exist out there at all. That's the kind of thing that wisdom literature would do. It's not written to specific people. And so I can't ask, what are the specific problems that these people in the dispersion are facing? That's irrelevant, because it's not written to real people. It's just a collection of, this is some good advice for anybody, anytime. But that makes a lot of difference. Good advice for anybody, anytime is going to read and be interpreted very different than, here's a specific piece of advice I've got for you in your situation. So there's no key, there's no answer key we can go to and say, look up James and see what's the genre so I know. I can only figure out what genre it is by exploring it and trying to see what makes the best sense. Just like with the parables, there's no answer key. I'm saying that they're analogies, but I didn't get that by reading it in a book. I mean, because you can find books that'll say that, and you can find books that'll say the opposite. It's a decision you have to make based on what makes the most sense, given what they are. Very few of these genres that we have in the Bible do we have outside evidence that we can say, see, it's just like that. It's like all these other ones over here. We have to figure out what it does by looking at the literature itself in the Bible itself. So that we're limited there to a certain extent, but we're way ahead of the game if we're prepared in the first place to recognize that such a thing as genre exists, that we don't treat it as just a series of pearls straight from the mouth of God, each one having the same weight as all the other ones, but that we understand instead that these are letters and poetry and parables and apocalyptic literature and narratives, did I say that? And that in seeing that, there are going to be differences between them that we have to take into account. Okay, well, that's my spiel for tonight.